Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Hello. We're going to be in the book of Job today. Job is one of those books that is so unique in the Bible. It deals with a question that humans long to know the answer for. It's a part of a unique literary genre known as wisdom literature. It seems to have developed in Israel during the reigns of David and Solomon because of the prosperity and times to do artistic work. It is not totally isolated linguistically from other cultures around Israel, like Mesopotamia, Babylon, Egypt, have similar types of literature, though the theology of Job is unique. One of the real problems in trying to date the book of Job is there are no historical references to people's names like Abraham or any of the patriarchs. There is no historical allusions like the Exodus or the exile or anything like that in Israel's history to date it. But because of internal evidence, it seems that Job is as old as the book of Genesis, the patriarchal period, because Job acts as a priest to his own household. There is no allusions to priesthood or anything like that. So apparently Job, the setting of Job, is the oldest in the Bible, the period of Abraham, the patriarchs. Now, as far as when it was written, no one knows for certain. Most people assume it's sometime around the reign of Solomon, and that's, I think, as close as we can probably get. Now, wisdom literature was a type of literature that tried to balance the law and the prophets. Or if I could put it this way, it was an attempt to bring down to everyday life the truths and revelations of God. And therefore, it's going to be a lot of poetry. The introduction is going to be prose. The close is going to be prose. All the middle is poetry. Now, the text of Job is in a state of disintegration. There are many words in Job that we have no earthly idea what they mean because they only appear in Job. And yet the message is clear and certain and sure, even though there is some question about words and phrases, and some verses do not seem to make sense as they currently are. But the overall message is crystal clear and deals with a problem that every one of us has. If God is all-loving and all-powerful, why is there so much evil and suffering in the world? And the connected problem. The Old Testament seemed to teach that if you're a righteous person, God will bless you materially. But if you sin, you will have the problems of disease and poverty and like. And Job attacks that traditional theology, as does Psalm 73 and other parts of the Scripture, as we'll get into it. When I do a new book, I usually try to show you one of the better commentary. And this is the one that I recommend for the book of Job. It is Tyndale Old Testament series put out by Inner Varsity Press. And the particular author of Job is Francis Anderson. And it's very helpful, and I think you're going to want to get a commentary on Job as we go through. But let's go to verse 1 then. There was a man in the land of Uz. It sounds like the Wizard of Oz, that Uz. Well, that's about how much we know where it is, too. There's been great conjecture on this. It seems that it might be in Edom. And that we get that from Jeremiah 25:20, Lamentations 4:21, and Genesis 36:28, where it mentions an Uz in the land of Edom, which would be southeast of the Dead Sea. But in Genesis 10:23 and Genesis 22:21, there is a land of Uz mentioned in the Fertile Crescent, over where we think of Babylon, and would be in Amram. And so there's another possibility. Tradition also says, that is recorded by Josephus, that Uz was northeast of the Sea of Galilee, which would put it in modern-day Syria. And so all these traditions, we just really do not know where Uz is. Notice it says his name was Job. Now, Job is mentioned in Ezekiel 14:14-20, along with Daniel and Noah. So obviously, he was a very famous personage. But notice his tribe is not given. It's not even really said that he is a Jew. Now, obviously, Uz is somewhere in the Transjordan area, on the eastern side of the Jordan, somewhere between Arabia and the Fertile Crescent. We can't be more precise than that. Now, the word Job, we get that, of course, from the Greek Bible, and the Hebrew looks a lot different from that. But there's a real fight over the etymology of this word. I have four possibilities. A famous American archaeologist, Albright, says that it means, where is Father? And that would be connected with the theme of the book, where is God? Some others say it refers to the Arabic root, which means the penitent or persecuted one. And others think it's related to the Hebrew root that means the opponent or enemy of God. We're just not certain. Now, and was a man blameless and upright. Now, in chapter 2, verse 3, this is going to be repeated. These two terms appear together several times in the Bible. Psalms 25, 21 is a good example. The word blameless is the idea of complete. It was used of sacrificial animals that had no flaw. Here it means that according to the light that Job had in his day, he conformed to the religious traditions that he understood with appropriate attitudes of praise and humility and that kind of thing. Now, the second word, upright, comes from the Hebrew word for straight, which is usually translated in English, righteousness. The word righteousness or upright is from a Hebrew word that means a measuring reed or straight edge or standard. And justification in the New Testament comes from the same root. Now, notice where it says, fearing God. Now, here we know he had an attitude of reverence toward God. You might well see Genesis 22:19, where the same thing is said of Abraham. And turning away from evil. Not only did he have a right attitude, but his life was circumvent, and he respected the religious tradition and the spiritual life that he had. Now, we're not saying he never sinned. We're saying he lived up to the best traditions and the best life that he had this day. Paul says he never broke the traditions of his youth. The rich young ruler said he had never broke the traditions of his youth. We have to take them at his word. It's not they had not sinned. It's that they had lived up to the best they know. Now, that's what they're saying. Well, this was a godly man. We could say that. Notice it says the word God, fearing God. Now, there are two different terms for God in Job. By far the most common is Elohim. Now, El is the general name for God, and Elohim is plural, and it's used throughout Genesis 1 and other parts of the Bible. The other word for God is used, we find in verse 7, is the word Yahweh, which is Lord in your English Bible with all caps. It's the covenant name for God from Exodus 3:14, which speaks of the verb to be in Hebrew. I am that I am. I am the ever-living God is what it means. Now, then it says in verse 2, and he had 7 sons and 3 daughters. Now, that's kind of an idealistic family. 10, the number of completeness. 7 sons, number of perfection. And that's kind of the ideal family, okay? Were born to him, and his possessions were. Now, we're going to list all his possessions. There were 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, and very many servants. Now, obviously, he was a semi-nomadic man, a herdsman, but also a farmer because of the oxen. So here we have a developed village, maybe an oasis where he lived. He was a very, very wealthy man by the standards of his day. Now, the word servants can be translated farmlands. You might well see Genesis 26:14. So it maybe means he had a lot of farmland. Now, the reason we mentioned female donkeys, they were the most valuable because they gave milk, and that's the ones they were usually referred to. Notice it says, and this man was the greatest of all the men of the East. Now, what do we mean by the greatest of all the men of the East? We are not saying that he was without sin. We are saying that his attitude was right toward God and that he was a very, very wealthy man. So we have a righteous man and a wealthy man. I want you to notice that God chose the best and the most prosperous that he had to suffer this persecution that's going to come. Now, that's a biblical truth. Jesus Christ, the book of Hebrews says, was perfected by the things that he suffered. The whole book is going to attack the traditional Old Testament theology that prosperity was a sign of God's blessing and that poverty or sickness or problems was a sign of God's displeasure. That is not true as the life of Jesus so adequately depicts and the life of the early apostles and the early church. Now, notice what it says in verse 4. And his sons used to go and hold a feast in the house of each one on his day. There's been much discussion about his day. Is it his birthday? Is it an annual feast day? Is it a weekly day? We don't know. But the family had a good relationship. The sisters were invited. The brothers loved each other. They came to see each other and had this special feast day. And they would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. There is no sense here of a wild drunken party. It's just the normal festivals of a family getting together. And it came about when the days of feasting had completed their cycle, they went to every boy's home, that Job would send and consecrate them. Now, consecrate them has something about changing clothes and washing yourself. It was a way of recognizing that man is sinful and needs to be cleansed in the sight of God. Let me give you a couple of references. Genesis 35:2, Numbers 14:10, and 14. and rising up early in the morning and offering burnt offerings according to the number of them all. Now here is Job offering a sacrifice. This is the basis of the cultus of Israel, where sacrifice is seen as a way of dealing with man's sin problem before God. So here is Job acting as a priest to his own family and offering sacrifice for his family, much as Abraham and the patriarchs did. Now then it says, and he said, perhaps my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. Now the word cursed is literally the word blessed. There's a lot of discussion about that, but the context seems to imply cursed. Maybe they did something by accident, or maybe they said something presumptuously. Well, this is the basis of the Day of Atonement in Leviticus 16, that once a year there was a fast day and a special offering in case any of the Israelite people had sinned against God. Now there was no sacrifice for intentional sin, but for the sins of ignorance and passion there was. This seems to be a basis for that here in the Old Testament. Now it says, in their hearts. Now remember, the hearts in the Hebrew is a sign of the entire person, but primarily the mental processes, okay? Because the emotional processes would be in the lower viscera. Then it says, thus Job did continually. It was a manner of his life to live righteously and to act this way, and for his family to be conscious of their need for forgiveness and a right relationship with God. Now verse 6. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord. Now this is the B'ni Elohim. Everywhere in the Old Testament that the plural, the sons of God, are used, it speaks of the angels. And I think that's true of Genesis chapter 6, verse 2. Everywhere where it's singular, it can refer to the people of Israel, the king of Israel, or the Messiah. But plural, it always refers to the angels. Now here we have the angels coming before God. This seems to be a reference of the heavenly councils, not as equals that sit down before God, but servants that stand around to do God's bidding. That's what the word present themselves mean, to station themselves. Now, this word Elohim is often used of the angels themselves. Now, here it's used of God, the sons of Elohim. But often the Elohim are said to be angels. Let me give you a few references. Psalms 82, 1, Psalms 89, 5, and 7, and Psalms 97, 7. I can't read my own writing. 97, 7. Okay, now, Satan, the Satan, also came with them. Now, the Hebrew word Satan means adversary or accuser. Now, here, he seems to be one of the sons of God. Now, he comes before God. He's not the arch enemy of God in later rabbinical thought, and certainly in the New Testament. Now, I want to show you a book of Old Testament theology. This is the Old Testament Theology by A.B. Davidson, put out by T.N.T. Clark Publishers. This is the best treatment of the development of Satan in the Bible that I have ever read. And this is an Old Testament systematic theology. If you don't have this book, I really hope you'll get it, because it is so helpful. Now, there's a development, an intensification of the evil in the Old Testament that is certainly climaxed in the New as the arch fiend that Satan becomes. Here, he's simply the servant of God to do a specific task, which is try men. Now, notice where it says, by the way, I want to tell you this, that Satan is not mentioned after chapter 2, verse 7. Satan is not a major theme in this book, though he is a significant part of the setting of the suffering of Job. He does not appear in the epilogue at all. He is a servant of God that does God's bidding. He is a created being. Here he is one of the angels. There is no dualism. God, and then there's the creatures, and Satan is one of the creatures. And the Lord said to Satan, Yahweh said to Satan, from where do you come? Now that's not lack of knowledge on God's part. That is trying to get Satan to tell him what he's been doing. Satan answered the Lord and said, from roaming about on the earth and walking on it. You might want to put 1 Peter 5, 8, where it talks about that. The planet is already somewhat his domain, which seems to be a result of the fall. For I certainly, the serpent in the Garden of Eden was influenced by the evil one. And the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? Now, this seems to be an honorific title used of Moses, used of Joshua, used of David, used of the prophets. And so God is proud of Job. God is pleased with Job. He says, have you noticed, have you marked my servant Job? Now, this is what Satan says. God finishes. For there is no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil. There was action and a mindset. Attitude is crucial. Action is crucial. Now, and Satan answered the Lord, does Job fear God for nothing? Thou hast made a hedge about him and his house and all that he has on every side. Thou hast blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. Put forth thy hand now and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse thee to thy face. And then the Lord said to Satan, Behold, all that he has in your power, only do not put your hand on him. So Satan departed from the presence of the Lord. Now, Satan had access from between earth and heaven. This is obviously the scene in heaven. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I think it's very important we see this. Job did not know what's going on. God picked Job out to say, isn't that a godly, upright man? And Satan attacked him immediately in the area of his motives. And he said, the only reason that he serves you is because of all that you give him. I wonder sometime if we serve God only because of the benefits of being his children. Only because he answers prayers and gives us what I want. Only because he delivers us from evil and disease. Do we only love God because of all the blessings we get? Or is there something in the relationship itself that is vital and crucial? Well, Satan accused him of saying, well, he just serves you and loves you because of what he gets out of it. And God said, that's not true, and I want to prove it to you. Now, did that mean God had to show Satan? I think God uses human beings to show the angelic world something of the nature and love of God. Now, let me continue then. Notice that God had increased him. This kind of fits in with the traditional theology that God loved him and therefore he blessed him. Now, there's going to be a real reaction to that. Well, Satan left, and it happened on that day when his sons and his daughters were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house. This was either the beginning of the cycle or the end of the cycle. If it's the end of the cycle, it is the very day that Job would have offered sacrifices on their behalf. Oh, what a tragedy. The very day he prayed to God to forgive them their sin. The very day he offered his religious service out of a good heart to God, that's the day his children died. Well, that intensifies it, doesn't it? Now, and a messenger came and said, the oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding and the Sabins. Now, who are they? Well, we know they're Arabian tribe, and we're from the south. That's all we know. Attacked and took them. Look at number 16. And while he was still speaking, another also came and said, the fire of God fell from heaven, burned up the sheep and the servants. Well, there's 7,000 sheep. You talk about some kind of fire. Now, this seems to be lightning from 2 Kings 1:12. But, friends, it takes some lightning to fry 7,000 sheep. Maybe it's a volcano. Maybe it's some supernatural thing like the fire of Elijah on Mount Carmel. I do not know. Now, in verse 17, while he was still speaking, another came and said, the Chaldeans. Now, Chaldeans can be both a racial group and an intellectual magician group. Daniel is called a Chaldean. So it was a wise men group within the Babylonian Empire. But originally, it was an ethical group that lived in the Fertile Crescent. And that seems to be what it is here. All right? Formed three bands and made a raid on the camels. Now, the camels were a real source of wealth at this time, and they took all of them. And while they were still talking, another servant came. Your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house, and a great wind, seems to be a cyclonic wind, a tornado, came and hit that house. The house fell on them. The fact it wasn't a tent showed they had a semi-nomadic existence, because I'm sure his hired people had to move those flocks in large areas to get them fed. There were so many. But the man and his family lived in houses, not tents. And the house fell on them and killed all of them. And then Job arose and tore his clothes. Now, they had an inner cloak and an outer cloak. To tear one's clothes was to grab your outer cloak and rip it at the neck about 3 or 4 or 5, 6 inches. Now, if it was a woman, she would take it off and put the rip part to the back for modesty. It was a sign of mourning and horror and a sign of grief. So, and he shaved his head. Now, this was also a sign of grief because the Hebrews rejoiced in their beards, their full beards. It was a sign of tragic grief and shame. Now, later on, it became a pagan rite, and it is condemned in the law of Moses. But I think Job may precede Moses. It certainly does. And so here we have, it's just a sign of grief here, and it's not condemned. And it says he fell to the ground and worshiped. He prostrated himself, and he didn't blame God. He worshiped God. I also want you to notice that he doesn't say those stinking Chaldeans, those stinking Sabins, those servants didn't watch out good enough. He didn't start blaming people. He didn't blame God. It seems that Job felt that he was in God's hands and that God could be trusted, even though he didn't understand why, that he put his trust in the person of God, not in the gifts of God. And apparently he believed his children would be safe in God's hand. So he did not do anything but worshiped. Now, he's grieving. He's sad. But he's not bitter or sarcastic or arrogant. Naked I came from my mother's womb. naked I shall return there. Now, some see this as the idea of Mother Earth. Now, there may be something to that. For in Psalms 139:15, it talks about that we were formed in the depths of the earth. If it is, it's just an ancient metaphor for the idea that God brought us from the earth. Maybe it's the idea of being formed from the dust of the earth. I don't know. Now, mother's womb there, it's not talking about returning to the mother's womb. We're not talking about Nicodemus kind of discussion here. It's talking about the earth, apparently. Now, then it says, blessed be, the Lord gave, the Lord has taken away, blessed be the name of the Lord. Now, here we have the person of God linked to the name of God, which is very important for later theology. Now, I want you to notice that Job does not believe in fate, chance, luck, that kind of thing. He believes in one causality, and that causality is God. He believes that even though he doesn't understand why God did it, he doesn't know there's a personal force of evil out to trap him, he just believes in one causality. And there are many parts in the Old Testament that believe in this one causality. And we'll talk about that. Now, in chapter 2, there's really a second stage of the temptation. Much is repeated in the first few verses. I will not go through there. But at last, he says, Satan says, he will not hold fast to his integrity. God said he does hold fast his integrity, although you incite me against him to ruin him without cause. Now, this cite me, Satan did it, but God is the cause of it. Now, this is that idea of one cause. I get your pencils because you'll like to look these up. Notice Satan acts in chapter 1, 11 and 12, but it's God who acts in 2, 3. Look up Psalms 45, 7, 1 Samuel 16, 14, and 1 Kings 22, 20 to 22. I think you'll understand what I'm talking about. One causality. Now, and Satan answered him, skin for skin. Now, what does that mean? Well, that's a proverb, but we don't know exactly what it means. Maybe he's saying he freely offered his animals and children to save his own life. Or maybe it meant the only real test of a man is when he's on the point of death. It's something like that. Yes, all that a man has, he will give for his life. And so it's obvious what the reference is. So he says, all right, you have a chance to inflict him physically, but don't kill him. Now, he got some kind of dermatitis disease, skin disease, boils, leprosy. And he left town. He was apparently ostracized, and he's sitting on the garbage dump of the city. And maybe he's itching his sores, or he's doing something with a broken a pot. That's scraping himself, itching himself. It was terrible, unbelievable. Ostracized from his friends and family. A wealthy man brought to nothing, to the point of death himself. Now it says, then his wife said to him, now she had been much discussion about her. She goes by several names. The Targums call her Diana. The Testament of Job calls her Sittis. We don't know if she has a good motive or a bad motive. She just says, do you still hold fast to your integrity? Curse God and die. Now if her motive was, oh honey, you've lost everything. You're suffering so bad. Why not just go ahead and die? Maybe she was really caring about him. But if she's being sarcastic and saying, oh, you can't trust God, then it's a bad thing. There's been much discussion. The early church saw her as a very negative influence in the hand of the devil. The severest test that Job had was this closest loved one left who tries to get into doubt like Peter did to Jesus. But we're not certain. There's not enough information here. And then he says, don't be like the foolish women. Shall indeed I accept good from God and not accept adversity? In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. Now, the rabbis say he sinned with his heart, but not with his mouth. The truth is, his integrity is still there. He still trusts in God. The wife has committed the sin that Satan accused Job of going to commit. But Job has not. Now, Job's three friends, the Septuagint calls them kings, heard of this adversity that had come upon him, and each one of them in his own place. Eliphaz the Teamite. Now, Eliphaz seems to be an Edomite name, and Teamite seems to be from Teman, which means south in Hebrew. This seems to back up the Edom connection. You might want to see Jeremiah 49:7 and look at your outline. I have an extensive list there. Bildad the Shuhite. Now, this seems to be someone in the east, we learn from Genesis 25:6, maybe a son of Abraham even. Bildad. Then Zophar, we know nothing at all about. The Septuagint says he's a king of the Minyans, and we don't know who they are except a southern Semitic Arabian tribe, and that's all we know. Now they came and they tore their robe and threw dust on their head, a sign of mourning, and they sat down with Job for 7 nights. Now, we learned this was the length of mourning from the dead from Genesis 50:10 and 1 Samuel 31:13. The Talmud says that one cannot comfort someone mourning until that one speaks, and Job does speak in chapter 3, verse 1. Some say that silence is a kind of mourning from Lamentations 2:10 and 11. Well, these three friends sit down, And the rest of the book of Job is development of these three fins spouting traditional theology. And Job saying, that can't be right for this reason, this reason, and this reason. There is a cycle of speeches now between these three men, Job and Elihu and God. And we'll get into that next week. God bless you. I've enjoyed being with you.